Okay, so great. That was a great introduction, an earlier panel, and now we have another really interesting discussion that we're going to turn to. And for me, this is a real honor and a personal privilege to introduce our luncheon guest, Ambassador Susan Rice. Susan is certainly no stranger to the Women's Foreign Policy Group, and throughout her career, she has really represented the best of the values that we promote at the Women's Foreign Policy Group. We all know her from her public life. In the Clinton administration, she served as one of the youngest Assistant Secretaries of State ever, and then went on to serve as the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, and then as National Security Advisor to President Obama. In her terrific new book called Tough Love, Susan takes us behind the scenes of U.S. foreign policymaking during the Rwandan genocide, the bombing of two U.S. embassies in East Africa, Syria, Benghazi, and more. She gives a clear-eyed insight into these and other tough national security moments. Susan was in the room, at the table, and even in the crosshairs of American political discourse. What I liked most about Susan's book is not just the foreign policy discussions, it's also her personal story, which is really just as fascinating and captivating as the moments in the Situation Room. I think Susan really sums it up best. She said, "I aim to share what I have learned along the way, the importance of always doing your best, picking yourself up, dusting yourself off, and driving down the court to the bucket, all while maintaining grace under fire." That's Susan, that's for sure, especially the driving. And of course, there's no one better to interview Susan Rice than Susan Page. We definitely have a lot of Susans here today. The award-winning Washington Bureau Chief of USA Today. Susan Page has covered six administrations and reported from six continents and dozens of foreign countries. An author herself, she is currently working on a biography of Nancy Pelosi entitled Madam Speaker. So please join me in welcoming both Ambassador Susan Rice and Susan Page.
Thank you, Kathy. I've never been in a room with so many women who have name cards that have ambassador before their names. That is really remarkable. It's an honor to be here with this group and to have the opportunity to talk to such a groundbreaker who herself has ambassador in front of her name, Susan Rice. I'm gonna pose some questions. Please feel free to send up cards with your questions. I'll try to catch up with a couple of those. She is, of course, the author of this new book, Tough Love. I'm not gonna criticize the fact that the subtitle seems to end with a preposition.
Wait. My story of the things worth fighting for, I think it's at least understandable, even if it's...
It is. It could have been my story of the things for which they are worth fighting.
Right. You think that would have sold?
Well, I don't know. Possibly not. You know, one of the... Also, before we go to questions, I would just like to note that this would make an excellent Christmas gift. And I think they're going to be for sale afterwards.
They are for sale, so yeah. Feel free to buy for your friends and family.
You know, they would be appropriate for people who care about foreign policy or who care about politics. It'd be appropriate for Democrats, but possibly also Republicans.
I hope so.
For women, maybe also men. And, you know, if you get them autographed by the author, when you give them away as a gift, it will make you look important. She'll inscribe it with whatever you wanted to say, to my best friend Janet, or whatever you want, I'm quite sure. So I would definitely recommend this book, and congratulations on the book and on your remarkable career.
Thank you so much, Susan. Really appreciate it. Thank you, Kathy, for the introduction, and I just want to say thank you to all of the folks in the Women's Foreign Policy Group. It's an honor to be back here, and I'm very excited to be able to share this occasion with you.
You know, Kathy said something I thought was important about your book, which was that it's not only about foreign policy. It's also about you. And it is, you know, I've read a lot of Washington memoirs where you don't ever get a sense of the person behind the policymaker or about any personal struggles. In your book, you're pretty candid about your parents' divorce, the custody battle that followed that shaped you in various ways. Was it difficult for you to write about some of that personal stuff?
Well, it was really important for me not to write a traditional Washington memoir. One, they're boring. Two, they seem to be quite self-serving. And three, that's not what I was setting out to do. I wanted to share as best I could and with a lot of candor who I am and where I came from and what I've learned, with the hopes that it can be of use to other people. And there's no point in sharing what you've learned if you're only prepared to share the good stuff and the happy stuff. So I actually go back. This is very much a personal story. And you have to wait a ways before you get to the policy stuff. And it's a personal story that goes back to my parents and grandparents, even actually my great-grandparents. My mother's family were immigrants from Jamaica who went to Portland, Maine in 1912, and my grandparents had nothing. One was a janitor, one was a maid, no education. And they sent all five of their kids to college. Two of my uncles were doctors, one a university president, one an optometrist. And then my mother, who had a remarkable career in higher education policy, was instrumental in establishing the Pell Grant program and then sat on 11 corporate boards and was a corporate leader. On my dad's side, I talk about his background, growing up in segregated South Carolina, born in 1920, the grandson of a slave. That slave founded a school in New Jersey called the Bordentown School in the late 1880s that went on for 70 years to educate generations of African Americans in technical and vocational skills and also in college preparatory skills. And so this is the family I came from. I wanted to share that. I wanted to share what I'd learned from my parents and grandparents, which was such powerful knowledge. And then I wanted to talk about the forces that shaped me, and that includes what it was like to grow up in Washington, D.C. in the 60s and the 70s and early 80s. I had the great privilege of attending some of the best private schools in the city as a young African-American woman, and I learned a lot from that. I learned from my parents' really ugly and painful divorce, and I couldn't be honest about who I am without sharing what that was about and how it affected me, because among the many forces, that was as instrumental as any in shaping me. So whether talking about my childhood or my struggles as a mother and my marriage and being the daughter of ailing parents while I'm serving as UN ambassador and national security advisor, all of those personal elements are critical to who I am. And I think also, obviously, to how and why I performed in the ways that I did.
You know, sometimes when you go back and look at things in detail in your life, you understand things you didn't understand at the time. You figure out things that you had never figured out before. Did any of that happen to you in writing the book? Is there anything that you found illuminating to yourself?
Yes. I mentioned already my childhood, but I feel like I really, since high school, had been sprinting through my life, through college, through graduate school, through my early career. And I never really had time to process and digest, how my experiences, particularly with my family and their breakup, had affected me. I was just charging to keep going. So I learned a lot about myself and about my family, and even in the process, uncovered some really difficult documents, depositions from my parents' custody battle that gave me new insight into what I was seeing from a child's perspective, but now could appreciate from an adult's perspective. The other big learning was how much my time in the Clinton administration, particularly my experience as Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, also was a critical learning experience. I was 32 years old when I was named Assistant Secretary of State. I had started in government at age 28 at the National Security Council as a junior staffer, director on the NSC staff for UN Affairs and Peacekeeping. And I'd run the Africa office at the NSC for a couple years. And then I was nominated to go to the State Department. And I don't think I appreciated at the time the extent of the challenge that I faced as that 32-year-old African-American mother of a three-month-old child breastfeeding in the State Department, trying to win the trust and confidence of a career ambassadorial corps that was 20 to 30 years my senior, and predominantly white and male career officials. And I struggled in that period, and I made some significant mistakes, which I write about in the book. And I had friends and mentors who were kind enough to take me aside and say, you know, you're going to screw this up unless you make some significant course corrections. I talk about, with great affection, somebody who may be known to some of you, late Congressman Howard Wolpe, who in the second term of the Clinton administration worked with me in the Africa Bureau, but he was President Clinton's special envoy for the Great Lakes region of Central Africa. And a fellow political appointee, but one with, you know, enormous knowledge and experience. And he, as I write in the book, took me out to lunch about a year into the job at the Magic Gourd, which you all will know is a really crappy Chinese restaurant near the State Department. And he sat me down and he said, look, you're smart, you've got vision, you've got the support of the secretary and the president, but you're about to fail because you're too impatient, you're too hard charging, you're not taking enough of the input and the experience and the knowledge of those on this team, and I want to see you succeed, but this is what you're going to have to do. And that was an extraordinary gift. It was, you know, tough love in the purest form. He didn't have to take me out. He didn't have to share what he thought. He could have let me fail. But he didn't, and others didn't. And I learned from those experiences. So as I went in back to reflect on my personal and professional development, that time over 8 years, but particularly the latter four when I was at the State Department, were really incredibly important and valuable learning experiences.
So in the Obama administration, there were in fact a fair number of women who had positions of authority on national security. There was a time when it was you, Deputy National Security Advisor Avril Haines, Homeland Security Advisor Lisa Monaco. President Obama, I gather, used to have a word for the three of you. What did he call the three of you?
He called us the Furies. Very privately. And I reveal this in the book. I mean, we were paranoid that that was going to leak.
It has leaked now, and that, by the way.
I put it out. So that's not a leak. Right. With all of their knowledge and permission. He called us the Furies and joked, as I describe in the book, that it was the perfect moniker for us because we were fighting on behalf of the moral good and wouldn't suffer anybody who got in our way. And we protested, you know, this is sexist, and the Furies were foul-smelling hags. You can't call us that. And he said, no, no, no. You have to understand how perfect it is. And he then went about explaining how he thought it fit, which in many ways it did. And there's a funny story because one Saturday afternoon, Lisa Monaco came with the three of us, went into the Oval. And this is, you know, it's Saturday, so it's a little more relaxed and we have a little bit more time and it's more casual. And she brings in for the president to see a cartoon from The New Yorker, which I reproduce in the book. And it's called Furies 2.0. And it shows the three Furies with their nicknames. And Lisa had modified one, which was Passiva Aggressiva, which was supposed to be me. And she crossed out Passiva. And there's a famous Pete Souza photograph of the three of us laughing hysterically with the president leaning over his desk. And Pete's caption that he put the photograph out with said, you know, that they're laughing about a cartoon in The New Yorker that resembles the three of them without explaining the resemblance. So it was great. It was a huge privilege to be able to serve a president who greatly appreciated strong women and their willingness to give him their best unvarnished.
So What difference does it make? How is policy different, or policymaking different, or the practice of national security different because of the several women involved in doing it?
Well, it's different and it's not different. It's different in the sense that we really felt that we were a team. We had each other's backs. And by the way, the team also included, beyond the three of us, Susie George, who was the NSC Chief of Staff, Ben Rhodes, who was Deputy National Security Advisor, and Wally Adeyemo, who was Deputy National Economic Advisor. And so it wasn't all of us only women, but the three most senior were. And we disagreed often on substance, but we knew that we had each other's backs. And woe unto anybody who tried to drive a wedge between us, particularly from the outside. And I hope and believe that we also led in a fashion that was supportive of the human beings on the team. In other words, I think all of us tried very hard to lead people with an appreciation for their needs as individuals, whether they were mothers or fathers or, you know, wives of ill husbands or children that were struggling, that family came first, even in the hothouse of the White House. And President Obama underscored that from the top. So whether it was me with my mother in the hospital when she was dying, or whether it was a colleague whose husband had had a stroke, the message from the top down that we tried to underscore was, go do what you have to do to be as whole as you can as a human being, and we, the team, will fill in behind you. And it's simple logic. If you're struggling and you're at a horrible moment in your personal life, you're not going to perform well anyway. And if you have bosses and colleagues who you know value you as a human being and will be there for you, you're going to perform optimally. If you get the impression they don't care, then why should you care? And so that kind of leadership commitment, that kind of collegiality and compassion that thankfully came from the top down, I think we as a team were able to really impart as a core value of how we led.
So let me steal a great question from Sue Gordon, who I think has left. So you can tell her I gave her credit for this. In the Obama administration, best day.
You know, this is not going to be the best day of the Obama administration.
For you.
For me. There were many, but the happiest day for me had nothing to do with foreign policy. It was the day that the Supreme Court affirmed the right of gay marriage. And that was such a happy day because, one, it was so right. And two, it was so joyful, and it mattered in the most profound way to so many of our colleagues. And you know, I still get choked up thinking about it, but you know, we lit up the White House in rainbow colors, and everybody celebrated, regardless of, you know, their sexual orientation or who they loved. It was a moment of just pure joy.
So that's not, I wouldn't have guessed that. So worst day for you. Hey.
Too many to count. You know, I write about in the book, you know, some of the worst days definitely probably, and sorry Sue's not here to hear this, revolved around the Snowden experience. Some tough days around Russian interference in the election. But you know, I honestly can't name all the tough days.
Can't name all the bad ones.
But there were also a lot of good days when it came to national security and foreign policy. I mean, the opening to Cuba, and the fact that, as I write in the book, we really stuck the landing on that. I mean, we had 2 years of secret negotiations that never leaked, and we were able to unveil all the elements of those changes simultaneously and effectively. The Iran deal and many other, you know, days worthy of celebration, but pure joy, Obergefell.
Let's talk just for a moment about President Trump. Your book has...
Oh, man.
I know this is a surprise to you that we
go from pure joy.
Yeah. Your book
without interruption. Okay, I'm ready.
Your book actually, well, you introduce it in your book. You tell an anecdote about your first and last meeting with President Trump. Tell us about that.
So to speak. My first and only encounter with Donald Trump occurred at the 2015 White House Correspondents' Dinner, which you all will know is a odious affair, but an important one.
And it's a symbol of a free press.
It is all of that. I'm all for that. And
it has an open bar.
And I, by the way, I think the President of the United States should attend that with regularity and respect the press. But I digress. So I'm sitting at my table, one of these round tables, almost like you are, Kathy, and facing forward, and it was one of these breaks in the program where people are up and about milling and mixing. And I sense from behind this presence. And literally this presence is now grabbing me by the shoulders and almost lifting me out of my chair. And I turn around, and it's Donald Trump. And he hugs me. And I'd never met him before. So I was kind of freaked out. And he holds me. And by the way, I hasten to add, this was not a touchy-feely, physically uncomfortable hug. It was just uncomfortable because I don't know you, and you're big. And you're not letting me go. And he whispers in my ear, "You've been very unfairly treated over Benghazi, and you're doing a great job for the country." And I was like, wow. I'm not sure what to do with this. So we were asked to pose for a couple of photos, which are in the public domain. Both of us, I think, smiling more than we would wish in retrospect. And that was my only encounter with Donald Trump. So from that first and only experience, given how harshly he had criticized my boss and me and many of my colleagues, and this is only a few weeks before he announced his run for the presidency, I was made aware with firsthand experience of sort of the gap between what he's prepared to say in public and what he might say in private.
We heard Seuss talk about how President Trump uses intelligence and how it's the same and different from previous presidents. Now, you don't have the first, other than your encounter at the dinner, don't have firsthand knowledge about how President Trump uses intelligence, but you've observed him and you have a lot of experience in seeing presidents use intelligence. How would you characterize how he is similar to or different from previous presidents in terms of his attitude toward and his use of intelligence?
Well, I do want to be careful about answering that because I really am not in the room. And so to make a apples to apples comparison is quite difficult. From the outside, he seems not to either have confidence in what he's learning from the intelligence community or not necessarily have the capacity or maybe the patience to absorb it fully. And Sue was right when she said, you know, President Obama was a voracious reader. He read, you know, every night until 2 a.m, stacks and stacks of paper. And I think it is fair to point out that, you know, different people learn and process information differently, and that's not inherently, you know, a bad thing. What I worry about with President Trump is he seems to disregard information, whether intelligence or just open source facts, that don't accord with his predispositions. And that's, you know, that's not something that gives me comfort or confidence, you know, when it comes to national security.
Let me ask a question that is posed by someone in the audience. This person writes, "A number of former Obama administration officials have come out against U.S. support for Saudi Arabia and Yemen, and former Vice President Biden has said if elected, he would treat the kingdom as a pariah. Why do you think these statements are important, if you do, and do you expect President Obama to weigh in on Yemen or other Saudi-related issues like the murder of Jamal Khashoggi?"
Well, first of all, I am among those who have been critical of the Saudi role in Yemen and critical in public of our decision in the Obama administration to launch our partnership with Saudi Arabia and in Yemen. Actually, I should rephrase it, not so much launching it, but continuing it when it went off the rails. So I think that's something that, given how that conflict has unfolded, people of conscience have reason to regret. I'm not familiar with Vice President Biden's statement about treating Saudi Arabia as a pariah. In my own judgment, there are many, many reasons to be critical of and concerned about the direction of Saudi Arabia, but I don't think the United States can afford to treat it as a pariah. We have to figure out how to pursue our interests and values transparently and not excuse their behavior and hold them to account while not severing the relationship. And with respect to President Obama, I mean, I think the Khashoggi thing has is over a year old. I don't expect him to speak out on a wide range of foreign policy issues. I think he, despite all the provocations coming at him and his team from the Oval Office, has worked very hard to respect the tradition that predates this president, which is that, you know, former presidents are highly reluctant and the bar is extremely high to criticize the decision making of their successors.
Well, of course, it's not just decision making, it's also just the very fierce criticism President Trump has made of President Obama on almost every front. Yeah. It must be hard to restrain yourself from responding.
It shows some maturity, doesn't
it? Yeah. Here's another question from the audience. What was your biggest challenge? What was the biggest challenge you faced entering foreign policy world as a woman?
Well, I think for me, it's hard to, you know, disaggregate the elements of who I am. So my experience was, as I mentioned briefly earlier, I started in government at age 28. And I, you know, was young, I was a woman, I was African American, and all three of those factors, probably above all my youth, were among the challenges I faced. And yet, you know, I had two things that worked in my favor, at least. One was the support and the encouragement of extraordinary mentors from, you know, Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, who I, as I write in the book, had been fortunate to know since I was a child, former National Security Advisors Tony Lake and Sandy Berger, who were extraordinarily supportive colleagues and advocates, Richard Clark, who was my first immediate boss in government. These are among the people that helped guide me. So that was one good thing. And the other good thing was the lessons I'd learned from my parents, who taught me primarily in the context of navigating the challenges of race, but they apply equally, I think, to women and others who are among the onlys in a room. And that is, one, to do your best, believe in yourself, work hard, and as my father always used to say, don't take crap off of anyone. That was his mantra. Meaning, you know, if somebody is disrespecting you or dismissing you or bullying you, you stand up for yourself. You don't let them put you down. And when it comes to race, my dad, who, you know, as I mentioned, was raised in segregated South Carolina in the heart of Jim Crow and the height of lynching, who served in the segregated armed forces at Tuskegee during World War II, and then went on ultimately to become a governor of the Federal Reserve. His lesson about race, learned very much the hard way, was as follows. He used to tell me and my brother, and he learned this himself, he said, if my being black is going to be a problem, it's going to be a problem for somebody else, not for me. In other words, he understood at a certain stage in his career, and as I said, I think it applies to, you know, being a woman or whatever, that if somebody is confronting you with bigotry or prejudice, that in all likelihood that bigotry comes from their own insecurity. And then, you know, even as you're a woman or a person of color or whatever, and you're facing all these very concrete and real challenges and hurdles, you do have a choice as to how you think about yourself. whether you allow the bigot's definition of you to become your own, or whether you have your own self-definition that is one of worthiness and confidence. And he taught us that. And that was the most valuable lesson that both my parents imparted to me and my brother. That, you know, you may be the only woman, you may be the youngest, you may be African-American or gay or whatever it might be, and people are going to bring their baggage to bear. But you have to perform a sort of psychological jujitsu and let their problem be their problem, not your problem, and perform to your utmost. Because if you're carrying around that burden of worrying all the time, what are they thinking about me? They don't think I belong. Then you won't belong, and you won't be able to perform to your utmost. So mentors and my parents were what I think gave me what I needed.
Ambassador Rice, thank you so much.
Thank you.